Thank you for listening to Living on Purpose. And now we'll get back to my phone conversation with Dr. Bruce Lipton.
I'd like you to describe more about the cells, but I also want to just touch briefly on the conscious parenting aspect of your book.
Yes.
Because there's something going on in my mind here about the idea of taking responsibility for ourselves. I love your description of how we, right from the word conception, and maybe before that, we download so much that becomes our subconscious programming. Can we not then blame our parents? Do we have to take total responsibility for ourselves?
The blame game is a serious game.
It's huge.
When you put blame, then you also remove that you were participating in. That happened to me, and they did that. Interesting, because I used to close my lectures when I would, you know, go through all the stuff that we just touched on a little bit, and the audience hasn't really understood yet, but how the beliefs are acquired, the perceptions are acquired, and how misperceptions are acquired, and how those perceptions and misperceptions then give shape to our biology and our responses to life and all that. It's just a victim kind of understanding, and yet when I concluded, if you understand how the science worked, this was my conclusion. Here's what the new science means. And it says, you are personally responsible for everything in your life. Well, it was interesting because well, I had the audience just gripped by this new exciting science and perception and everything. Right up to the very end, they were like, yeah, yeah, yeah. And then I made that statement. All of a sudden, it's like, no, no, no. And it was funny how people can turn on you in a dime, you know. And I realized at some point, this is really not a good way to end the seminar. Near the end, I made my statement. You were personally responsible for everything in your life. And at the end, after everybody left, this woman came in. She was emotionally sobbing, and
yeah.
Her husband with her, to support her and everything. She said, I can't buy the conclusion that I brought things into my life like this. And I tried to think, well, is there another way to say this and still maintain the truth?
Mm-hmm.
And I kept thinking, but this is the truth.
Mm-hmm.
And then all of a sudden it hit me, and I said this. No, how about this as a conclusion, I say. You are personally responsible for everything in your life once you become aware that you are personally responsible for everything in your life.
Okay.
And the moment she actually heard that, she said, okay, I got it. I can accept that. Meaning this,
yeah.
If I never told you that you had personal responsibility, I never programmed you, never gave you that information, and then reprogrammed you in ways that I wanted,
mm-hmm.
and then your life lived that way, even though I know now, from my scientific point of view, you are personally responsible, you didn't have any insight. As a matter of fact, anytime you really started going toward personal responsibility, there was a tendency of your family or the system to take that back away from you again. No, who do you think you are, young man?
You know, yeah.
Like, okay, there's your limiting factor right there, you know. Okay, if where I'm standing today, what does it mean? It says, okay, I look back at my life, I say, wow, the first 40-some years, that was filled with a lot of horrible, scary, you know, I don't want to go back there ever again situation. But now when I realized, yeah, but I was also participant in those situations, but I was unaware of that. But now here's the point. Where I am now is, but wait, I do understand that I'm involved. And if I am involved and I know I'm involved, then what I can do is say, okay, the past was a learning period, and the current starts now. And the current says, let go of the past, because if you didn't understand how it operated, and nobody did, there's nobody to blame. It's an experience, it's a history, and all that I need to carry forward is some of the information I acquired, but I don't have to do all the behaviors and responses that I did before. So I can let go of that.
And what you're saying, Bruce, is exactly something I think that works really powerfully, because your belief is so strong. And if you say, that's the story of my life, or I'll never change, or that's always the way it's been, then there you are. But if you say, up until this point, I have believed this, but today I believe something else, then your mind can go with that, right? Because there's a distinction between then and now.
Well, that's it, because remember, the nature of how cells work, and so now we can put this...
Okay, let's go into cells, yeah.
The cells respond to the environment, meaning how do they do that? Well, they see the environment, what's going on chemically or, you know, in the, inside the body, what are the hormones and chemicals that are passing by. The cell is like, in a reality, a miniature human in its own world, so
yeah.
That 50 trillion citizen community called the body, there are 50 trillion little people doing jobs. And they're getting information from the government with the form of the chemicals being sent down from the top that tell them what to do.
Yeah.
And so they read the information and adjust their biology to the information that comes from the environment. By definition, as I describe in the book, the process of reading an environmental signal and then turning it into a biological behavior is a process involving perception, by definition. And so why is this relevant? Cells perceive the environment and adjust their biology to what they perceive. Well, cells in a community don't directly perceive the environment, because in the community they allocated a group of cells and said, look, you guys become heart, you guys become stomach, take care of digestion, you guys become lung, you take care of respiration, and you guys, the central nervous system, your job is to do what? Read the environment, tell me what's going on, consider all the implications, and then send down the integrated coordination that how we're going to respond.
Mm-hmm.
So the cells say, I read the environment, but I only read the local environment. I get the information about the big environment from the brain. So the brain of the human is like the brain of the cell that was reading the environment, except the human brain reads it for 50 trillion cells. So the human brain reads perceptions of the world. And so it looks at the stimuli, tries to interpret what they mean, and then adjusts the biology to make a response that will keep the biology alive. So
mm-hmm.
we talked about go outside and it's cold out. To stay alive, you have to raise the body temperature. So your perception of cold activates your metabolic activity. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
So now the issue is, okay, so the human and the cell are the same as living organisms. They adjust their biology in regard to what the environmental signals are, and the process of the environment being translated into biology is perception. Okay?
Yep.
So it's how I perceive the world that controls not just my behavior, but my genes. That's epigenetic control. And then the significance says, yeah, but as we mentioned before, sometimes my perceptions are right and sometimes my perceptions are wrong. Regardless of they're right or wrong, the cells are still going to respond to the perception. That's
mm-hmm.
the Henry Ford statement. If you think you can or you think you can't, you're right. Whatever the perception is, that's what it is. Okay, now we go back and say, okay, now built into the human biology then is the concept of a mind. The function of the mind is to gather all this information that's coming in, interpret it, and then send a signal back into the body. Well, the interesting thing is, we have two minds, one called the conscious mind,
yes.
and one called the subconscious mind, and the difference between them are profound in this regard. The subconscious mind is the equivalent of an autopilot. It reads the environmental situations and adjusts the biology without us even thinking about it. So when you go outside, you don't have to think, is it cold or is it hot? The subconscious mind read the temperature and adjusted it for you automatically,
mm-hmm.
okay? The subconscious mind does automatic programming. The subconscious mind doesn't just read physical things, but it also reads social and community interactions as perceptions of the world, too.
Mm-hmm.
It has to learn them, because I can give you a genetic perception of, let's say, calcium. The cell will read the calcium in the environment without learning about calcium. It's programmed that with a perception for calcium. The calcium shows up. It has a device to read it, and
mm-hmm.
then, so it's built in. But when you get to higher levels of organization, then it's not just things like calcium and adrenaline and estrogen that are signals. It also is, hey, what's going on in your neighborhood? You know, what's your family doing? These are environmental influences that affect your life.
Sure.
So what we now know is this, that the two minds exist. The conscious mind is more or less a mind that's connected with our personal identity, and I would go as far as to say our spirit, okay, that
mm-hmm.
are as personal individuals. The conscious mind's the thinking, creative mind. But the subconscious mind is a simple record playback. It just records and plays back. It learns from a habit and then plays it back without thinking about it again. And so an interesting thing that we now know is this. In order for us to get off the ground as humans in our community, we have to get fundamental rules to participate. We have to learn the language. We have to learn the rules of I'm the dad and you're the baby. Okay, let's get that hierarchy straightened out. This is the policeman, and the policeman is very important because if he says stop, you stop. This is your friend Billy. If he says stop, you can go on or not. That's not the same. Policeman says stop. So we learn every little rule. And what we now know is that the two minds are involved in learning the rule, but the conscious mind doesn't participate early in the game.
Mm-hmm.
As a matter of fact, we now have information that the conscious mind really starts to engage in a sense of our creative character to ourselves after we're 6 years of age. First 6 years of age, the dedication of the mind is to download all the rules of society and family and community.
And boy, do we do that well.
We're designed to do that. That's an instinct. When a baby is born, the first thing it will do is look into its mother and father's face and stare at it. And the reason why is a genetic program. It says it learns to distinguish a happy face from a scared or angry face right away. Because if you have a baby, or if you've been around babies, what you'll watch them do is if they're crawling around and they bump into something new that's not in their database and they've never experienced, they have an automatic instinctual response to look back at the parent's face. What they do is when they look back at the parent's face, they get the interpretation of the parent is of the thing that they're just encountering. Is this good or bad? If it couldn't be there, the face of the parent will be either angry or scared. And the baby will immediately connect the whatever this thing is I just bumped into, this is good for me or not good for me based on what my parents say. So the immediate learning isn't like a child, a baby doesn't have any inherent conscious ability to make a decision. So the mind doesn't allow it to. It just says, look at this code and this will tell you what to do. So our beginning period of life is directly tied in to our parents' perception of life because they're the teachers and the mind of the child is programmed not to be self-creative, but is to download these important messages right away. Some of the programs that are naturally built into the system, we call them instincts. They don't need programming. They're already there. People demonstrate every day. A woman could be in a tub of water, and the baby come out of the birth canal, and by itself will come up to the surface of the water, and then turn on its back, take a breath of air, and then turn back around and go down under the water. And the behavior is almost like a dolphin.
Wow.
And it can do this instinctually. All animals can all mammals can swim. You take any mammal, a cat, a dog, a horse, never been in the water before, throw it in the water, it will automatically swim. Okay? All mammals can swim. But then comes this funny question, and it's sort of like, well, Johnny might be able to swim when he's born, then why do we have so much trouble teaching Johnny how to swim when he's 5 years old?
Yeah.
And it's, well, what happened between birth and 5 years old in regard to Johnny and swimming? And the answer goes like this. When Johnny was an infant, every time he got near water, the response from his parents, remember, look back at his parents' faces?
Yeah.
They would be in fear. And in fact, if Johnny was near the water and nobody was paying attention and the parents saw that, they'd scream, Johnny's down by the brook or the river, the pool, the ocean, you know, scream to go save Johnny from the water. Well, Johnny's not a stupid child. He's downloading.
Yeah.
And what he does, every time he confronts what he sees as water, he gets a signal from his parents. And the signal says, this is dangerous, it will threaten your life. So what happens is, for the first 4 years, he has repetitive habitual learning that every time he gets near water, that water is a threat to his life and his parents freak out. So now Johnny's 5 years old, and now the parents deem it's time for Johnny to learn how to swim. And so they put a bathing suit on Johnny, and what's their first effort? To throw Johnny into the water. And Johnny is screaming his bloody head off, and the reason is why? Well, you've just taught him 4 years in a row that water is going to kill him. In his young mind, what do you think is the meaning of the behavior of throwing him into the water? And the answer is you want to kill him.
Right.
And guess what? The fear is so overwhelming that even the instinctual ability to learn how to swim is forgotten at that moment.
It's just frozen, yeah.
Frozen. And the reality is that if Johnny were actually allowed to swim from day one, Johnny would not only be healthier and smarter, but he would have a much longer life than if Johnny didn't swim. So all those fears that we put in about the water have actually interfered with an ability for a great exercise for newborn babies in this regard. Because our conventional exercise for newborn babies, well, you put them in a bassinet or the crib or whatever they call those things, you know, and you wait for the baby to, you think the developmental stage one, the baby turned itself over. Well, how long did that take? And the reality is, why can't the baby have moved earlier? And the answer is, when the baby's born, it hasn't exercised any of its muscles. It's not even coordinating them. And it turns out that, as you know, if I'm not an athlete, but I exercise, I become an athlete. When a baby is put into water, the instinctual ability to swim is a natural exercise regimen. And because the muscles are so weak, it's like the equivalent of hydrotherapy. You get a patient in a hospital that's been in bed for months, and you want this person to go home now. You don't just say, put your clothes on, get out of bed,
no.
Go home. They collapse. Their muscle strength is gone.
Sure.
So what do? They put them in a swimming pool because the water is buoyant. Holds them up, they can use a lot less activity and still move.
Still work with the resistance of the water and
right.
build them up,
so
yeah.
When a baby is put into water after it's born, it has the opportunity and ability to exercise itself
right.
and strengthen the muscles, while the other baby who is just laying in the crib sits there until frustration gets it to do isometric exercises, that is, push itself over.
Mm-hmm.
And that takes a long time and a lot of frustration on the part of the baby as compared to a baby who swims. Because in this development of the swimming,
mm-hmm.
it enhances the cardiovascular system. And enhancing that, it also provides more cardiovascular development to the brain.
Mm-hmm.
And the brain develops better than it does in a child that doesn't do the exercise.
Mm-hmm.
You get more powerful yeah. children exercising an innate instinct of already knowing how to swim.
Yeah, you kind of think of letting babies sort of laze around for a few years until they really get into the action, but you're right, there's different ways that you can participate in that development and strengthening. I'm trying to figure out the relationship between the conscious and subconscious mind, that expression, pushing his buttons.
Yeah.
Part of what you say is we're really, really dominated a lot by that subconscious programming, and yet no one's there, and yet the conscious mind seems to want to avoid it.
Yeah, but how come it doesn't?
Yeah.
Ah, okay, now we go back to, we talked about the subconscious mind. It's a downloading device.
Yep.
It downloads behaviors and responses to the environment. A little scary piece of this data, that it actually started downloading while we were in the fetal stage of life. What's interesting about it is, well, what kind of information was it downloading then? The
mm-hmm.
answer was the emotional behavior of the mother.
Right.
If the mother was happy, then the baby was bathed in a happy environment. But the mother lives in fear or threat or concern about the survival of herself or her child. That information is passed on as stress hormones, which the child also reads. So the child is now growing up in a milieu of stress, and,
mm-hmm.
and these stress hormones are programming the baby even before it's born. And here's a scary one, that when a child wasn't expected and the conception was, you know, not in plan
right.
or anything like that, and there's like, oh my God, what are we going to do with this child? How can we afford this? Oh my God, this child's going to interfere with our lives and all that stuff. Well, this is a conversation between the parents. They don't recognize that the hormones that give the sensation of rejection
mm-hmm.
are bathing the fetus at this time as well, and that the fetus is also learning rejection even before it's born. Teaching didn't start just when the baby was born. Teaching
No.
started about midway through pregnancy, when the nervous system was capable of downloading recurring patterns and experiences. A lot of us were pre-programmed, and people adopt an orphan think, well, you know, like, it was just a newborn baby I adopted. It's like a clean slate, and I'm going to help this baby. And guess what? With all the things I tried to do, the baby grew up and became a troublemaker and all kinds of things like that. And they're trying to reflect on, but I provided everything. And it turns out, well, that was really nice, except you didn't realize that the baby already had a program rejection before it got to you, and that was already built into the behavior.
Yeah.
So the baby didn't come as a blank slate. It already came with programs. So all of us did. So we got a lot of these programs, and the first 5 years is observe the world, observe how our parents respond to and the stimuli in their lives. So we learn by observing them what the stimuli are and what the responses to the stimuli are, and this goes into our subconscious mind. So as we grow up, many of the stimuli in our environment that we encounter, if these were stimuli that our parents dealt with, then we will automatically engage in the same behavior that our parents dealt with and dealing with that, because that's what we learned, okay? Well, here's the point. You said there are two minds. Yes, after six, the conscious mind starts to arise, and that's the one that has the self-identity, and it's self-reflective.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the ability of that mind, that's the subconscious mind, the first one, which is, in fact, physically a million times more powerful than the conscious mind. The subconscious mind learned programs, and as you mentioned, you know, the push my button.
Yeah.
The subconscious mind is tantamount to like a jukebox.
Yeah.
You push the button, it's going to play the program. Well, if you got the program when you were born in the first year of your life, guess what? You're now 50 years old. You push the same stimulus, you're going to play the same program just as if it just happened again the first time anyway. And the point is, the subconscious mind is a downloader of experiences, which are programs, and connects them to the stimuli. So if the stimuli ever show up, you automatically push the button and the program is pre-recorded. It will play automatically.
Mm-hmm.
It's very convenient because, for example, we'll go over something that we deal with every day, walking. we had to learn how to walk. That was a very difficult process at the beginning, of learning how to stand up, stay in balance, and move with momentum and not fall over. We don't think about it. At the neurological level, this is a feat of amazing technology,
mm-hmm.
dealing with thousands and thousands of muscles and nerves interacting and keeping each other dynamically engaged as little changes in pressure and momentum.
Oh, yeah.
We can stay in balance. The point is this. If you had to use your conscious mind to walk, A, you spend most of your day trying to move.
Yeah.
And there wouldn't be any other thing to focus on, because it would require consistent, focused, conscious attention of trying to deal with thousands of muscles at the same time. But the subconscious mind can download the pattern. And if it does that, then my conscious mind doesn't have to think about walking. In fact, it never does.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm thinking about going over there. I don't have to first put the command in the system, now walk, right leg, left leg, right leg. I don't have to do that. My intention is to walk. My subconscious mind says, oh, okay, I have the program. You don't have to think about it. On the way over, while you're walking, think about your vacation next.
Yeah.
So the subconscious mind's function is to do routine tasks, repeatable things, and to do them without engaging the conscious mind. So as I use in the book as well, the example of driving a car. When you first got your driver permit, there was no program in your subconscious how to drive a car, so you drove with your conscious mind.
Mm-hmm.
You were alert. You watched everything. Now that you've been driving the car for 10 or 15 years, you can put the key in the ignition, start to drive down the street, to have a passenger in the car, get involved in a conversation,
mm-hmm.
and then sometime look out the window and it dawns on you that you haven't paid attention for 10 minutes. So the first question is, well, if you weren't paying attention, who was driving the car? And
yeah.
I tell you the subconscious mind, and then here's why it's not scary. Subconscious mind's a million times more capable of observing the universe and responding to everything faster than your conscious mind ever could. Matter of fact, if you're driving a car and you're about like sliding or getting into an accident, your conscious mind gets shut off and you operate from your...
Yeah.
It's much more effective. It's faster. So while you might say, oh, geez, I didn't pay attention to the road, at least I feel, in one regard, well, a more powerful mind was actually driving anyway.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that's not so bad. But then comes this is the big issue. This is the take-home lesson here.
Okay.
The take-home lesson is this. You just drove 10 minutes. You were in conversation. Your conscious mind was involved in conversation. And you drove for 10 minutes, and I say, well, describe your driving behavior during that 10 minutes. And then you look at me and go, well, I didn't see it. I was involved in a discussion.
Yeah, right.
And then I said, yes, this is the point. The conscious mind and the subconscious mind have a reworking relationship. The conscious mind can regulate any part of our biology in our life. If you want to change your blood pressure, you can do it with your conscious mind. You want to change your heartbeat? You can do that with your conscious mind. You can focus on it. Yogis get into that meditative state and then can regulate any aspect of their biology. The conscious mind is a relatively small processor. It can't handle too many different tasks. And so the function of the conscious-subconscious relationship is this. The subconscious mind will carry out every task that's ever been learned without the requirement that the conscious mind pay attention. So I can drive the car and have a conversation.
Mm-hmm.
And so here's the trade-off. If the conscious mind can't focus on something, the subconscious mind will automatically do whatever it is. So let's say you do a job, a routine kind of job. You could be doing the routine kind of job and then be thinking about your vacation. And yet the job is being done.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just like driving the car. If it's automatic, it will automatically do it. But the fact is this, when it does it, it will always automatically do it exactly the same way, because you push the button, it's going to play the same thing over and over again. Well,
mm-hmm.
here's this issue. It says that, here's the relationship. Conscious mind is very creative mind. The subconscious mind is a total habitual mind. It plays habit. That's all it does. The creative mind is smaller and can't focus on everything of our lives. So whatever the conscious mind is not focusing on, and something that needs to be done, like driving the car, the conscious mind does it. But then here's the trade-off and the catch. Because the conscious mind was busy, that's why the subconscious mind was operating. Yeah, but because the conscious mind was busy, then by that nature, it wasn't paying attention to what the subconscious mind was doing. So what it says is this. When the subconscious mind is carrying out its behaviors, we rarely observe them because it's carrying out the behaviors because we're busy doing something else. Here comes something that most people might be familiar with, and I like it because in lectures, people start to they shake their head and they go, oh, yeah. It goes like this. Let's say you know somebody, and you know their parent, and you observe that this person and their parent have the same kind of behaviors. And then you say to your friend, Mary, you know, you're just like your mom.
Yeah.
And then you realize that that's not greeted all the time with best of, like, oh, thank you so much for that. It's like, usually it's shock. Like, how can you say that?
I'm an individual.
Yes, right? Is that the conventional response? Here's the point. This is the lesson for the listener out there.
Okay.
Like, if I see that Mary and her mother share the same behavior, how come Mary doesn't?
Yeah.
And the answer is, because her mother's behavior was programmed into her before she was conscious. It's in the subconscious. It plays automatically when? When she's not paying attention. So that when she does behave like her mother, she doesn't see it because her conscious mind's not observing it.
Oh, man.
Take that and you add this one last piece, and then you see where, oh, and this last piece is this. Neuroscientists have now revealed that on a day-by-day basis, 95% of our behavior comes from the subconscious mind. And why is that relevant? Well, if we don't observe it, then it says 95% of our behavior is not even observed by us.
Oh,
it's automatic. And yet the issue is this, but whose behavior is it? Go back and realize that the fundamental behaviors of how to deal with life were downloaded before you were six and were programmed by the people in your environment. And so the programs that you are operating 95% of the day are not your programs. They're programs of the way other people responded.
And how they responded to the people they were downloading from.
Exactly. So that your parents learned their behavior from their parents, who learned it from their parents. And the issue is this, then most of us are operating on a day-to-day basis with a programming database of programs that we were not involved with when they were downloaded. We don't even critically watch them because we don't see them when they play, and yet they control our lives.
I don't know what you think about the idea that we choose our parents before we were born. Suddenly that concept has gotten a lot more complicated.
Well, to me, it doesn't, because this analogy plays very well with, I think, the direction of where we're going. And that is, in today's video games that kids play,
right,
they're role-playing games, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And when they get into the game, they select a character.
Right.
But in the selection of a character, then they get a choice of traits. The early ones were like a war game or something.
Yep.
So I'm a soldier. I'm going to jump into this game, and I'm going to be a soldier. But it says, before you jump into the game, well, here's your choice. You could have 5 rockets and 6 hand grenades and 2 machine guns. Oh, no, you can change that. You can have 10 rockets, but you have to give up the machine guns. Or, no, if you get more grenades, you can get less rockets and more machine guns. You know, you pick the traits, right?
Right.
So that now you pick the traits, then when you push go, you jump into the game, and guess what? Your character plays the game with the traits that you provided with it, and what's your point is to win the game.
Mm-hmm.
And so what you have to do is manipulate the traits that you selected to play them in the game and win the game. I see us coming in, picking the genetic traits,
yeah,
and the family to learn the program. And even before we start to play, because we didn't play till we're 6, really, that when we jump in by 6, we've already have the traits, and the nature of the game is now that we're in the body and playing the game from the inside,
mm-hmm,
we forgot that we were outside.
Mm-hmm.
That we were like the people, you know, if it was a computer game, that were pushing the buttons on the computer, we become the character on the screen.
Mm-hmm.
And the nature of the game is, to win the game is to take the traits you came with and beat the system, or to take the traits you came with and learn the fact that you aren't the traits, but you're the person outside the game.
Yeah.
And when that happens, then you become powerful.
Well, yeah, because I found in my own life and relationships is that I recognize that programming, and I see where my buttons are pushed, and I see how I go into automatic responses that don't serve me and don't serve other people. And I've seen how I can make choices where it's almost like going against the force of gravity or swimming up a current. I go, okay, this is how I normally would have reacted to this, but now I'm just going to play with this. I'm going to react in a totally different way. So it becomes a playfulness, an experiment,
well,
right?
But see, that's where your power comes in.
Yeah.
Your power is in your conscious mind. We've gone on a track here, and I really need to correct this. This is a very important point.
Okay.
The subconscious mind is neither good nor bad. It's a playback device.
Right.
The quality of its function is related to the programs that are put into it.
Mm-hmm.
Meaning, if I only got negative, bad, crappy, disempowering programs every time I operate my subconscious mind, I'm defeating myself. Okay?
Right.